Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain, where we lift the curtain on politics and theater. You know, two areas a lot of people think don't ever meet, but here they do. As the political analyst for WGN-TV and host of CLTV's Politics Tonight and Broadway in Chicago Backstage on the Comcast Network, we'll touch on everything from national, international, state, and local politics to the artistic side of our city. We're going to feature the hottest shows and theaters because when it comes to theater, New York, watch your back. Chicago gets it right. Plus, we'll look at other social and legal issues of interest to you each week, hoping to spark a little interest, ensure meaning towards the bigger picture, and maybe even spread some knowledge along the way. Get ready, everybody. We're going to raise the curtain. We're looking behind and underneath the scenes. Let's get to it. Well, here on Behind the Curtain, we always start with a political segment. But today, I wanted to do something a little bit different because it is such a pleasure whenever I can grab this friend to join me. You got to just do away with whatever else you wanted to do, in the first place. And whenever it's a focus in on the best of theater, I think it's certainly worth the time, certainly as we're in the beginning part of a new year. Joining me is the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, Chris Jones. Chris, you know I love you. You know I think you're just fantastic.
No, and stop.
You and I have said before on the air that we agree about 95% of the time, and the other 5% of the time we don't agree.
And you're wrong.
That's what you've always said. So, hey, I do want to take a look at the 2016 Best in Chicago, Best on Broadway, Best Performances. You did sort of create three different lists on all of that.
Yes.
First, let's get to the current news of the day.
Yes.
Kind of big news. Joshua Henry, who I think is unbelievable as Aaron Burr in Hamilton, going off to do the national tour.
Yes.
I think you actually had written that you suspected you saw Wayne Brady roaming around.
I heard he was knocking around. Yes. My network of sources.
And there he gets named. And you just talked to him. Fill us in.
I did. Well, you know, he's an interesting choice for the show because he's a star, frankly. And there's a few things about stars and shows. Number one, they're not in Chicago usually. They don't like to come to Chicago, especially in the winter when it's cold. So that's number one that makes him different. Number two, he's a replacement, and generally stars don't like to replace people because they're stars. And further, he's replacing somebody, as you just pointed out, Joshua Henry, who's fantastic.
Oh, yes.
So would you want to follow Joshua Henry in that role? No, you would not. So all of that makes it a bit different. Talking to him today, what was interesting, firstly, he had all of these publicists on the line. And it was like, can we do this in 5 minutes? Can we do it? And I'm thinking, this is very L.A. And he's here in Chicago. We don't really operate quite in that manner. And I was thinking, wow, this is really unusual. But here's the interesting thing. I think he's going to be able to use a lot of that because Aaron Burr, as you well know, Paul, is a sort of he tells Hamilton in Hamilton, talk less and smile more.
Right.
And what Wayne Brady was saying to me this morning was that that is basically what he figured he had to do when he was a young African-American man making his way in Los Angeles, smile at the suits and don't make any trouble, And he says, as I got older, he figured out that sometimes you have to use what platform you have to actually make some noise about things. And I think, and to put all that to encapsulate all of that, I think he will see himself in Burr as a star. And I think that will make it actually a very interesting performance. So if you've got tickets to Hamilton beginning after Tuesday of next week, then you will see Mr. Wayne Brady. If you have tickets in February or March through the first week of April, that's who you'll see. And I think, I haven't seen it, and I'm going to go and see it. I feel like I'm going to give him a few days to get in. I don't want to be there on the first night. That doesn't seem fair, does it?
Makes him nervous.
So, but I'm going to go because I think it could be a very interesting performance.
Which means we're going to get a review.
Yes, you are.
Wow. But by the way, he's not new to the... I mean, he did go in after Billy Porter.
He did.
He was in Kinky Boots on Broadway.
He did Kinky Boots, and he also did Billy Flynn
in Chicago. Right.
But, he got a little testy with me because he said, why am I unusual? And I said, well, you're a star. And he said, well, I think he was... I think he was worried that it would be perceived as stunt casting. And he's not stunt casting. He's a bona fide Broadway guy. And I actually think it's a very interesting casting. But it's indicative, Paul, of the power of that show, that he just wants to do it. And I bet they said, well, we've got a Burr in New York. He didn't want to tour because he's too busy. So I bet they said, why don't you go do it in Chicago? Any other show, no guy like him would be doing a show in Chicago.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't. It's the way it is. But they are for Hamilton.
Incredible news, and as you say, it's not even he's not even stepping into an Alexander Hamilton role, right?
Right.
I mean, so he goes into. I mean, it is a key role in it, but yeah. I can't wait for your review, Chris, because
it's
to be
really
honest, I'm sorry for somebody to. And I know everybody I've ever seen in that show is great, but Joshua Henry was spectacular,
stunning. I mean, better than Leslie Odom Jr.
Yeah, I kind of agree.
Better,
yeah.
No question. He's a spectacular performer, and I suspect he's leaving Hamilton to showcase himself a little on the West Coast. Would be my guess.
Probably
I mean,
because
that tour is playing L.A. and San Francisco. He's not well known in the Hollywood, you know. And often actors from New York like to get out there, particularly in a show like that, where everybody in the business is going to go. So I can see why Joshua Henry would do his, you know, few months here and then, you know, and then go. And then from the show's perspective, they get a burr that's fantastic, and they can anchor the whole show based around
because
it.
They need to give it a little PR, right?
They do. They always do. They can always charge more. This
right.
is what people don't understand about that show. Even if it's sold out, it's not about that. It's about how much.
Exactly.
How much can you get?
And, you know, I'm actually next up for the John Lawrence Philip Hamilton role. I don't know if you knew that. I can count in French. That's all I had to
all
do.
All right.
Hey,
good.
So you know what? I'm not going to do on these lists. I'm not going to, like, go 10-9-8. I want to do that. I'm going to point on certain shows. So we're talking about Hamilton. Dude, number two on the list. How did you not make it number one?
Well, you know, just cause. But obviously it was an excellent
show. It was too easy to make it number
one. It was too easy. Now, but then my number one was just a show that I just sort of thought was really extraordinary, which is the show called The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window at the Goodman Theater.
Which was great. It was
which
great.
Was really great. It was, and it was written by Chicago and Lorraine Hansberry, who everybody knows for A Raisin in the Sun. But people don't know that other play, which is written, you know, it's about Greenwich Village in the 1960s. And I just thought it was a revelatory production of a play written by, you know, for my money, perhaps the greatest writer Chicago ever produced. So it's one of them in the top three. The problem with Hansberry was simply that she died very young after she'd not written very much. She left town. But people forget that Chicago had this great genius. And that play, very few people had seen before. And it was a revelatory play for me about a Chicago writer from the South Side who just doesn't get the respect she always deserves.
And so it sounds like when you do these lists, so people, it's not a matter of, yeah, that's just great performances, that makes you number one. There's a lot of factors going into these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I try to sort of, you know, because often you've got very different shows, and I always think it's wimpy to go in alphabetical order. You know, who wants to read a list in alphabetical order? Do you want nobody? So I'm always like, okay, I'm going to make myself really ask myself what actually was the very best? What was the very best production?
So, and you did do a nod because you did point to Joshua Henry as one of the very top performances.
Well, that was a fantastic performance.
Right.
I mean, by any standards, it was I think the best performance of the year in many ways. It was an incredible performance as Aaron Burr. And no one, of all the people I've known and all my readers who've been to see Hamilton, no one's come back and said, you know, you kind of overrated Joshua Henry.
No, you can't.
Everybody
do it.
Comes back and says it was a great, great, great piece of acting.
Another show that made it both into the top 10 list as number four, but also you give a absolutely well-deserved nod to the great performance of Alex Weissman,
yes.
is the show Hand to God at Victory Gardens, which I was there opening night. I sat in the front row. You know, you get a little messy in that show when you sit in the front row sometimes. A little blood spatters your way.
Well, Hand to God was a Broadway show that I saw on Broadway that was much better in Chicago because it was deeper and more honest. And Alex Weissman, who played, you know, it's a show, if people haven't seen it, it's a show set in Texas about a very troubled young man who, you know, is part of a church there and is just dealing with stuff that young men deal with. But what makes it distinctive is that this kid has a puppet, an evil puppet on his hand that's like a psychological puppet for him. All the mean stuff he can't quite say himself, the puppet speaks. And of course, it's controlled by the kid, so it's really the kid speaking. We all know that's the point of the play. But it requires from the actor sort of two personalities. It's like playing, you know, the devil and Mrs. Jones. It's,
yeah.
it's two things together. And Weissman just really managed to go from one thing to the other in that. And it's just a superb way. He's a fantastic young actor. And, you know, he remains one of the sort of Chicago theater's brightest stars.
Wait, the puppet wasn't talking?
No. Okay. You think he was?
I missed it. Yeah.
You thought he was real, Paul?
Right. But I'll tell you one thing, because I told other people to see the show, but, you know, when you hand to God, you got to be curious, because if there's somebody out there going, well, I'm very religious, I would love to see a show that extends its hand to God. I'm like, no.
It was really about psychology and about, you know, and about the intersection of faith and psychoanalysis, you might say.
So then there's a couple of shows where you get a performance on the great performance list, yet the show itself didn't make it. And I'll specifically point to one which caught my eye, End of the Rainbow.
Yes.
Doesn't get your nod for one of the best of the year, not even in your top 20 if I read the list right. But then, of course, Angela Ingersoll, and I had the pleasure of doing a talk back with the cast towards the end of the run. Just, she was astounding.
That was an astounding piece of acting for anybody who saw it. This is Angela Ingersoll, a Chicago actress, not a famous actress in any way, really.
But her husband is.
Her husband was in Jersey Boys. Yeah. They're a very talented pair of folks, and Angela's performance in that was sublime. And it is very difficult to be really great as Judy Garland, because so many people. I would say in my 20 years doing this gig here in Chicago, I must have seen 20, 30 Judy Garlands. I've seen all kinds of Judy Garlands, from the outré to the credible. And this was the best I've ever seen. And it's a character, especially because this play is set towards the end of, you know, with the booze, the pills, when it's all coming to a head. It's a cliche, Paul, and it's easy to fall into that. And I thought this was a performance that avoided that. And I thought it was a very, very beautiful piece of acting. Now, the play itself isn't very good. It's okay. It's a sort of a fairly standard setup. She's in a hotel room. She's got a sort of a pianist who's trying to keep her on the straight and narrow. She's got her latest husband with her. It's pretty much, you know, what went on when Garland was playing the talk of the town in New York, just as it was all beginning to become unsustainable, you might say. But the play itself, there's no particular literary or other merit to the play. It is simply a vehicle for an actress.
But, of course, and by the way, for people who just love music, you do get – I mean, Angela was so dead on in her voice and everything else that if you're a Judy Garland fan – you know, the night I did the talk back, there was somebody in the audience. He had driven in from Minneapolis.
Really?
And he said, I had to see this show. A huge Judy Garland fan, and he was over the moon with it.
Well, it's – you know, you get to – as you say, you get to hear all of her great – you got to hear all of her great songs in the show. And the point of the show is that, of course, like a lot of stars with troubles, she could still perform even as everything else was falling apart. She was still good. And in fact, what Angela did brought to that performance, Paul, was the sense that it was her troubles that underpinned the musical performances. In other words, you could actually see, okay, you know, the reason she was always so good was partly she just went into performer mode, I suppose, but also that the truth of the lyrics to those songs, the depth that was brought by the real Judy Garland, came from her biography, came from what was going on in the rest of her life. And that's what Angela really brought to that performance. It was a stunner. I wish more people had seen it. You know, one of the things that ticks me off in Chicago is that shows often close before people have the chance to see it.
Well, I will say, with regard to that show, one of the things Michael Weber said to me, that show had to close. There were other things coming into space.
Right,
that's part of the problem with a lot of
exactly.
theaters. It's not the show isn't doing well. He could, and in the Heights, he could have run for another month, he said. I want to ask you about that, too, but we'll get to that. You also gave a nod to Linda Ryder, who's been – didn't see Rose, who played Rose Fitzgerald, Rose Kennedy.
Yes.
And I interviewed her on this podcast, so people can check that out from a previous show. A nod to her, but I want you to sort of comment on that, if you would. Within the scope of what the Greenhouse Theater Center is doing with Jacob Harvey, which is this whole series of single-person performances. Now, Gene Wigand didn't make your list
I didn't see that,
fine performance, but I was going to say, I don't think you reviewed it.
No,
I think
I
you had
I
seen
see it.
You'd have put him on this list.
Really? I wish I had. In this job, sometimes you can't get to everything, especially if it opens on the same night or something else. And that was one of the ones I missed, which I regret, frankly. I am going to see another. There's a couple more solo shows.
I'm going to go in to see that.
And there's a couple more solo shows. I like solo shows. And this one you're talking about here with Linda Ryder was an example of an actress who was, you know, I hate to use the phrase journeyman actress because some people find it condescending, but I mean it here to indicate someone who's been around for a long time, who has always done the work, walked the walk, talked the talk, but maybe, you know, you haven't found in the headlines. And Linda Ryder is certainly that actress, and, you know, an actor's actor, you might say, and was really terrific here as Rose Kennedy. It was kind of a sleeper show, but it was a moving piece because constituent to that piece of work is the notion that Rose Kennedy is asking herself late in life, was it all worth it? You know, did this family, the Kennedys, with all of the tragedy and, of course, all of the amazing accomplishments of so many of her children, did they overreach? Would everybody have been happier if they hadn't? And it's, you know, one of those questions that we all ask ourselves. And Linda Ryder made that a very profoundly moving experience in the theater because, you know, even famous people, at the end, you ask yourself these same questions about life and about, you know, whether what was worth it, you know, what brought you happiness and what did not.
You know, the when I interviewed her, I see this might be coming from my world of journalism, which is just the importance of doing homework. So when I interviewed Angela Ingersoll about End of the Rainbow, and we did that on the podcast as well. She talked about the research she did, the life she lived. I mean, she's just lived Judy Garland since a little kid. When I asked Linda about her work for Rose, she basically said, I just read the script.
Oh, really?
And I'm sort of curious. Yeah, that was sort of curious to me because when you have a historical figure that you're presenting, and of course I know who doesn't of a certain age group remember Rose Kennedy, but you kind of wondered, do you expect, I mean, just as a critic, do you expect when people take on roles that they're, in Hamilton, for example, they're doing some homework to find out who this historical figure was?
Well, I think it depends. I think I would say sort of, you know, different strokes for different folks in some ways, that some actors really bury themselves in that kind of research and decide that that's how they approach a character like that. Others argue, you know, and this is a reasonable argument to make, that everything you need is really in the script, in the sense that if you're playing a character written by someone, the reality of that character is what's on the page and in that script. And some people would argue that, you know, if you read 8 different biographies all with different points of view, it can actually end up confusing you more than it can help you, you know. So I think it depends on the individual actor's process. I think you're right, though. I think in general, the more you know about somebody you're playing, especially if they were real, then the more, you know, then the better you are. But, yeah, you know, to go back to Wayne Brady for a second, I'm, you know, how relevant to playing Aaron Burr is Hamilton? Is the real Aaron Burr? Now, you could argue very relevant. He was a real person. The show is based on historical fact. It's been lauded for that. On the other hand, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote it, has written Burr in a particular way, right? And so what really anybody doing that role is focused on Lin-Manuel Miranda's version of Burr, which is not the same thing as Burr, the real guy. So I think actors have to sort of walk that fine line between those two things.
It's fun to see the change, too. You know, the earliest line, you know, the famous line in the show now, I'm back to Burr, and I'm the damn fool who shot him.
Yes.
Do you know what the original line was?
What?
I'm the genius who shot him.
Right.
Interesting change.
Yeah.
You know, I am incredibly impressed with Porchlight Music Theater. I think that I've interviewed Michael Weber on the show. I think they do incredible stuff. You give a nod out to Donna Colin from Dreamgirls, who absolutely deserved it. Dreamgirls didn't make your top 10, did make your top 20. So I want you to talk about Dreamgirls, but then you need to explain yourself, Dr. Jones. How did you not put In the Heights on this list?
Well, I thought In the Heights was pretty good. I didn't think it was great, 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 great.
So it took 3 greats to make the list.
It took 3 greats. So I see a lot of shows, Paul. I mean, it's, you know, you're culling from like 150. And I thought it was a pretty good show. That's a difficult show to do. Porchlight, in that case, needed a large cast. There were all kinds of casting issues with that show.
Yeah, that's true.
But I actually liked it. I thought more worked in it than didn't, which I don't mean in any condescending way. I thought it was a generally successful production. And Donica Lynn in Dreamgirls, who Donica Lynn was my Chicagoan of the Year in theater here in the Tribune. And the thing about Donica is, you know, she'd been very public about her struggles with cancer. And despite, you know, the need to have chemo and also to raise her kids, she still managed to turn in 2 incredible performances last year. One in Smokey Joe's Cafe at the Drury Lane Theatre, which was astonishingly good, and one then, you know, as Effie White in Dreamgirls, when, you know, she did it, she gave a performance at Porchlight that I thought was every bit as good as that by Jennifer Hudson in the same role. Every bit as good. Yeah. In fact, you know. Just because somebody's a star doesn't mean they're better. And I think that Donica's performance was really, I'll never forget it, right? And so a great performance, as you know, Paul, they live with you. And you talk to people on shows like this, and you talk about those performers. And then maybe years later, when everything else is forgotten about what you did in the year, some of these performances that you get to see They live in your mind and your heart, and that's sort of what the best of the year is all about.
Yeah, and by the way, just a nod, Ethan Slater from the SpongeBob, the SpongeBob musical. It took on a role, had to create. It was his first professional role.
Yes.
I did my backstage show with him in the cast, and it had Gavin Lee, who had been Bert and Mary Poppins. A really interesting venture. What do you think the future of that show is?
Well, they're looking for a theater on Broadway. I think it will go to Broadway. I don't think that's 100% certain, but I mean my sense of talking to people in New York is that it will, if not this spring, then in the summer or the fall. I mean, it's good enough to open on Broadway. It would be crazy for it not to open. They've got a bit more work to do, I think, on it. Partly because I think if you like SpongeBob, you had a really good time. If you've never heard of SpongeBob, you didn't know what the heck was going on.
Right.
And so that's always a tricky thing in commercial art of any kind. You've got to also appeal to people who don't know anything. And that show, that's difficult to do because SpongeBob, are you a fan? Did you watch it?
I did not grow up with that show.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of people like you. So those people.
I don't know about that.
You've got to, they've got to broaden the appeal of the show is what I'm trying to say. And in other words, it's got to be great for the SpongeBob heavy fan and somebody who doesn't know anything about sponges that live on the bottom of the ocean also has to have a good time.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is on Broadway. You've got to have a broad audience base.
Well, Honeymooners is coming to Broadway soon, right? I mean, now that one, I know. There's my era.
There you go.
Hey, I also wanted to ask you before we run out of time. I always need an hour with you, so I'm going to postpone our Broadway discussion.
Okay, very
because
good.
You know what? The Tonys aren't that far off.
No.
And let's have
Broadway
that discussion
later.
When we get
Perfect.
Closer. Dear Evan Hansen, so many shows to talk about
yeah.
there. But I want to ask you about Meryl Streep. But you don't need to tell me your feelings about how you agree with her, disagree with her, or whatever, although I know how you feel. But what is your thought about people who just say, you know what, she was given a lifetime award, a lifetime achievement award for the Golden Globes? That was not a place for anybody to make the statement. Now, of course, because a lot of liberals love what she said,
yes.
The way I had to think about it is, what if she had gotten up there and did a pro-Trump speech?
Yes.
How would people feel?
Well, it would not have gone down well. That's
no,
true. That's
no. So I'm just curious, what is your thought about actors who take that moment and turn it political?
Well, I think actors, like any other artist, have the right to say what they have to say. I was very supportive of the Hamilton cast in New York addressing the vice president, partly because I thought that, you know, it was a play about the presidency. The vice president-elect was in the audience. They addressed him politely. To have not done so would have been to ignore the elephant in the room, no pun intended, and they were a right to do so. And I think Meryl Streep has earned the right, when getting an award, to say what she has to say, briefly, cogently, articulately. And I think Trump has just got the very same American right to say, you know, overrated, or whatever he said,
yeah.
he tweeted. I think he's got the right to do that. And I think that's democracy working. I you know, nobody wants a bore. Nobody wants to see actors, make things about their views when they're not supposed to be. But I think when getting the award that she got, she is entitled to say her thing. And this idea that artists have to stay in the corner and not be political is nonsense. They are political creatures. I'm a great believer in free speech, and I think she had the right to say what she said.
So if she would have done a pro-Trump speech that people
would
like, you'd back her for that, too?
I would indeed.
And I know you did, you have written about the Pence moment. You took you had some difficulties with that from viewers. Listen, I talked about it on air as well.
Yeah, a lot of people disagree with that.
Doesn't take much to get the hate tweets and everything else.
Well, I think if it had been cats, Paul, it would have been a better argument. Like, do you want the cat coming out and saying, Trump, it's so terrible? You don't, right? But it was Hamilton. It was a show about politics. And I think that, for me, in that case, made it reasonable.
Old Deuteronomy could have gotten away with it.
He could have. Yes, he could.
Old Deuteronomy. All right. I need more time, and
right.
I'm getting cues. I
next
know
time.
We're running out. Please come back. You know
it.
I'm crazy about you.
And
we will talk again about Broadway next time around.
You got it.
And for now, I will thank you for all your brilliant, and I just can't wait. I have to read your reviews before I decide if I like a show.
My pleasure, Paul.
Thank you, Chris. Well, now go. Walk out the door. Just turn around now. Because you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one? Hurt me with goodbye. You think I crumble? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll still lie. I've got all my. I Will Survive, sort of a mantra song that a lot of people know, and you would certainly know it and will know it a lot better when you see a show that is playing at the Pride Arts Center, the Broadway Theater in Chicago. What a classic show this has been. It's been on Broadway for so long. It did a national tour, and it's coming home here to Chicago, so to speak. It's going to be opening here. It is Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical. And this is, if you haven't seen the show, it is so good. You will know the music. It has just so much pop music. But what a great story it is, too, kind of a story for current ages. And I want you to meet part of the cast and the co-director of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, opening in Chicago and creating so much buzz and excitement. Joining me, the co-director, David Zak, because he's also the artistic director of the Pride Arts Center and Pride Arts and Films. I've known David for just so many years, back when he was running the Bailiwick Theater Center, and he's just, his whole life has been in the world of theater and the arts. And also joining us, Honey West, a name that many of you in Chicago know well as a cabaret performer, as an artist in so many ways, as an actor in a variety of plays, and now she plays the lead, Bernadette, in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And David and Honey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, this is great. I can't wait for the show. It's going to open January 12th, going to play through February 12th. And David, how did you decide that Priscilla, obviously such a great show, but this is a pretty big production. This is a big one to tackle if you're doing it the way we've seen it. Is there going to be a bus on stage? Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, it's really fun that Chicago has a great reputation for the storefront theaters, the Apu theaters, tackling really big projects, really big musicals like Dreamgirls, or, you know, we did The Boy from Oz a couple of years ago at Theater Building. So the city has a great reputation for people, for audiences embracing those smaller versions of these huge musicals, because you get down to the really great stories. You get down to the great music. You're inches away from the performers. You get to see the storyline, and a lot of times you get to cut away a lot of the sort of craziness that happens when a show is on Broadway. So we were excited to get the rights to do this first local production of Priscilla, and it's perfect to open this new space for us, which is on Broadway at just north of Irving Park. And
yeah,
it seemed like a really sunny, fun way for everybody to say, hey, we're here, and come celebrate with us.
And of course, it's an incredible show. Honey, you are the star of this show. You play the character Bernadette, who was played by Terrence Stamp in the movie. It's a transgendered performer. And I don't know, what made you think of doing this role?
Well, because they asked, and they asked if I was interested, and I said yes. I'm one of the stars. You know, there's Luke Merdick and Jordan Phelps.
And John Cardone.
What's that?
And John Cardone.
And John Cardone, of course. You know, it's such, when I first was introduced to the play, and David had mentioned it, I saw the clips from Broadway, and I saw this huge circus and this excitement and the music I love that I grew up with, but I didn't realize how much heart and how much story and really the storyline of homophobia and abuse I didn't realize how poignant it still is after all of these years. Of course, I love the movie, but it's so relevant. And between the costumes and the music and the dancing and the story, it's got everything in it.
And honey, let me take a step back, because we kind of assume a lot of people know what Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is all about. Some people don't who are listening to the podcast. So let me invite you to give us the thumbnail sketch of the plot of this. Was a movie, what was a musical, and now it's here.
Yeah, I mean, it started as a movie. It talks about three entertainers. One is a transgender older actor older performer, and the other two. One is probably younger than Bernadette, of course, and then there's the young Adam or Felicia. They end up going on this journey across the Australian outback. And if you've ever seen the map of Australia, I've just recently started studying, and around the coast you have the major cities, but in the middle there's virtually nothing. There's rock and there's desert. So they get on a rickety bus to go and meet one of the entertainer's sons that he hasn't seen in 8 or 9 years. And what ensues and what they meet in the outback is it's a full journey for all three of them. All three of them go through a complete journey of finding themselves, finding each other, finding family, finding love, exploring loss. It's packed full of everything. And
there's a lot of lessons learned by a lot of the characters in there, I know. And David, I have to ask you, I mentioned the music, and we came into this interview playing I Will Survive. So many Broadway shows are known for all the brand new original music written for them. But Priscilla's a little bit different, right? Priscilla is for folks who just have a love of disco and whatever. They're going to know this music.
Well, they will know this music, and it's been an interesting process, I think, for people who love to read about the history of Broadway musicals and how they take shape. This musical premiered in Sydney, 7 or 8 years ago. Then it opened in London, and in London it had some songs that were that were brand new to London that weren't in the Sydney production. There were some things that they could get the rights to for Australia. There were some things in the movie that they couldn't get the rights to put on stage. Then when it moved to New York, it did the same thing. It lost a couple numbers along the way. And now this production, which is a local production, has some other new numbers that have not been in either in the movie or the Broadway production or the touring production. So
is that
I think
your,
people will be surprised.
Just curious, is that your selection or you and your co-director? I mean, who made the decisions of what music will go in it? Do you have the freedom to do
that?
The people
who are licensing the show. Have those sort of powers to sort of say we have these materials. If you're talking to Cyndi Lauper or whoever wrote, all these great material that's in the show, I'm sure they're negotiating piece by piece with these with the agents who own these music. Your song is just going to be in the Broadway show or the touring production, but it's not going to be in the resident productions that come farther down the line. That's not something we're ever privy to. We just get the scripts and the scores and go, oh, here's a new song that none of us were expecting. But what's great about the material is whether it's a ballad or whether it's something silly like MacArthur Park or whether it's, Kylie music, it all really works to tell the story. And so even if it's a disco song and all of a sudden you're listening to lyrics in a new way that you might have been dancing to, you might have been doing the hustle to, 30 years ago, all of a sudden you listen to lyrics, and some of them are really quite moving and really fun and also really profound, like I Will Survive. And so I think the piece is in very much, a family. It's about, reconnecting between parents and children. And I think that's something that people universally respond to. It's very much a story about people in the shadows coming into the light of being accepted, whether those people in the shadows are the country bumpkins who they meet along the way or the stars, they're very flamboyant stars. Everybody wants to be part of a community. And in some ways, that's what this journey is, bringing everybody out of the shadows into this powerful sunrise, which is how the play ends. So it's a great story. And I think the music with Robert Ellis has a 5-piece band, and they sound awesome. As do the
singers. They sound like 20 pieces. It sounds just like the Broadway soundtrack. It's amazing.
I love that. And, of course, David, you sent me back into the shadows with the memory of me doing The Hustle 30 years ago, but which I actually think I was fairly good at, but that's a whole another concept. So, and honey, for people that have followed your career here as I have for so many years, and I mean that in a, not an old person way, but I mean, I remember you. It's always kind of that double-edged sword kind of comment. But
it's wonderful.
Yeah, you're working Diva Diaries and Jerry's Girls, Tony and Tony's Wedding. So many awards. But I believe, and David, I think you have said this. You are a trans actress, and I believe this may be the first time. I mean, Terrence Stamp, folks who played this role were generally male actors playing the role. This may be the first time a trans actress is playing Bernadette. To your knowledge, is that true?
To my knowledge, it is. I've from just the pictures and the articles from Broadway, Australia, London, India, Mexico, that I believe that the only one I know of is me. But you know what? You never know what you don't know.
In terms of playing this role, let me just ask you, is this a greater challenge? Very, very comfortable? How did you approach this?
I approached it. I thought it would be... It is a challenge because there's a lot. There's dancing and lots of stuff I haven't done in a while. But as a trans actress, I thought there might be a lot of of things I would bring to the role that maybe some of the actors that had previously played it didn't. But actually the story and the heart that Bernadette brings to the story is kind of universal. I may have, the sensibilities that I have as a trans woman, playing a trans woman, may be subtle at times, or it may be kind of obvious to some people. I don't really know at this point, but I know that the more I get to know Bernadette and the more that I get to play with her and the other actors on stage, the more I realize how much of me is in her. I am an older actress, and I am an older trans woman, and I do, you know, have the biting jabs, and I do have the heart, and so it's, I've come to know her, and I've come to love her. I really have.
Well, I'm very excited.
Honey is just one of the funniest performers ever in Chicago. So people who know her from her cabaret act know that she can get a laugh out of the phone book. You know, so it's really great to have somebody in the role who's very, very funny, but who also knows the rage and the sorrow and the, you know, the pain that a journey like this character has made. Obviously it's really authentic because in many ways it's Honey's story as well.
And I think
that's
what makes this so beautiful. And I know, by the way, I had Charles Bush on the podcast last week. He'll be appearing on that stage end of January. He'll be on that Priscilla. He was wondering whether the bus would be there. So I couldn't answer
him a ride.
Couldn't answer him when we talked. David, for people who want to see this January 12th through February 12th, give us the details, the website, so people can get tickets.
PrideFilmsAndPlays at .com, PrideFilmsAndPlays.com. It's a relatively young organization that produces movies and stage plays that always have LGBT characters or themes, but we feel like our audience is everybody. These are things, especially in this era, how interesting that we're in a new era of what are we in? We don't really know, but in this era that we're moving into, it's really important to tell these stories. It's even more important to tell these stories. So PrideFilmsAndPlays.com, or they can call 1-800-737-0984, and they can get tickets really easily. The theater is 85 seats, so you're only a row or two away from the action, and you'll definitely leave wanting to do the hustle.
I'm excited to see it. I can't wait to see it. David, Zach Honey West, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical is what's on the agenda. Congratulations. I know it's going to be a phenomenal show. I look forward to seeing it. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.